He has a spot.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. It was his that he pulled in last night. It was late after all of this. He just backed it in. He said, I didn't even notice the sign was down.
Did you show it?
Yeah.
So much for Greenwich Mean Time.
We haven't been late like this.
I was just gonna say.
I think since the first year we.
Yeah.
Representatives.
We're going downhill.
You got your mic.
My song in the corner, please.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Can you please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag.
The flag, United States of America, and to the Republic which stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Sorry. Yeah.
The morning, Wade.
Come on, moving along.
Can I have a motion to approve the minutes from our October meeting, please?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And we'll jump right to the financial report. Good morning, Wade.
Thank you, Commissioner.
No change.
PowerPoint up and we'll walk through the results through the month of October. Okay, on the first page, you can see our consolidated results for the 10 months ended October 31st. The first number that's highlighted up at the top is local governments, and that's because we received almost $1.4 million in October in this past month. Two things really stood out, and so I wanted to raise those up. We received our $500,000 sponsorship from Cross Country Mortgage, which would have been recorded there, as well as a $225,000 sponsorship from Metro Health. So those two numbers helped drive that $1.385 million in October, which then drives the year-to-date total. We're still lagging 21 by almost $11 million. We've talked about this at other meetings, but I think it's important to just keep reminding everyone. In 2021, we had so much grant revenue that ran through that line between the shuttered venues, the American Rescue Act, and then we had some Tiger monies coming in. So we're never going to match the $21.7 million. And by the end of the year, it'll be closer to $27 million. We're just not going to see that unless we get a year where we get that many grants again. In a typical year, we wouldn't get that. Charges for services, right there. That is up year to date, and that's primarily due to golf and enterprise. And we'll talk about that more in detail later. We've talked about golf every month. It seems like they're having a great year. But as we drove in today, I'm thinking that the golf revenue for greens fees might be tailing off a little bit now that we won't be seeing gift cards. Down at the bottom, you'll see, You'll see right there, we have a $1.7 million positive. I mentioned this last year in October of 21, we had three payrolls. This October, we have two. Last month in September, it was the exact opposite. That times up on when you have two or three payrolls. So it just looks a little different. The year to date, we're about $5 million over. And you can see we're about $2.8 million over on operations. We'll hit both those and they affect every operating unit. The salaries and benefits line is due to us being at full staffing or what is about full staffing compared to we weren't at about full staffing in the calendar year 21. Operations are up due to commodities cost, fuel, inflation. The one thing I did note is that the inflation rate that was just reported a couple days ago was 7.8% for the month. And that was being celebrated because that's the lowest month-over-month increase over the last 8 months. So it just speaks to last month when we spoke about this, CPI was 8.2%. So we're still wrestling with that. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. Even if it inches down to 7.5 or 7, it still has a dramatic impact. And that'll be something we talk about when we talk about the budget, when we do the preview later, is that that's impacting operations. Our cost of doing business is going up. But we don't want to miss the point that as an organization, we've got a $40 million positive year to date. Last year was 55, but let's not lose sight of the fact that the organization as a whole is doing extremely well. With $40 million in excess or operating surplus that can be then deployed to other areas of the park district. Lastly, I did highlight that we're running pretty consistently on CapEx. We're tracking pretty close to what we spent in 21, only in a little bit different categories this year. You can see there's a little less this year in construction and a little bit more in capital equipment. Land acquisitions were a little bit higher last year than this year, year to date. But we do have some land acquisitions that we'll talk about. So those things could all catch up. When you look at the holistic picture, it's a good month and we're doing well on a year to date basis. Next, let's talk about the zoo. The first number that's highlighted, you can see in October, we had a Zoological Society payment of $493,000. This year, we get zero, which we're tracking about even. I checked into that the minute I saw that. And that's because $573,000 hit the books on November 10th from the Zoological Society. So when we do the November report, we're going to be looking very, you know, very good. We're going to be running ahead of last year. It's just due to the timing of how they do their payments. And we've talked about that also. But I thought that might raise a question. Why do we have a zero? And that's because it didn't hit till November 10th. You can see that our total revenues were running pretty consistently with where we were, not real bad. When you get down to operating expenses, we're over. And again, for the primary reason of salaries and commodities, those two costs are up. And then the last thing that I felt we should at least raise up for everyone is the almost $1.4 million in construction over at the zoo right now. And that's due primarily to the admin building and Tropical Bears, which we're still working on both, but that's what's driving this number up here in construction expense. So again, the zoo is doing well. It's tracking pretty close to last year. It's wrestling with those almost $800,000 in increased costs due to inflation, fuel costs and things. So all in all, it's doing very well. Golf, same story. I mean, it just continues to outperform and do well. This month, 77,000 over what it was last year in October in greens fees. As we joked, that might be tapering off, but it tapered off in November of 21 also. But year to date, almost $550,000 in total greens fees over. You can see that in terms of net results, it's about $3 million net operating surplus compared to 2.8 last year. And that's absorbing almost $1 million more in expenses, nine or more in expenses, because you're fully staffed. You've got the commodities expenses. I say this each month, but it bears saying again, golf is just doing extremely well. They should be complimented. Damien and his team are doing a great job of controlling expenses, and people are playing a lot of golf, and it's really, really doing well. And then the last part was, even after CapEx expenses, their CapEx expenses are running a little bit ahead of last year because we're doing some more work at the golf courses than we did in 21 year to date. And we have some things planned. Again, when we talk about the budget for next year, there's some things that we need to do to improve our golf courses, maintain our assets, and improve the experience, which I do think then will drive this top number. As you invest down here, that drives this number up here. Here's the individuals. Simply, if they're shaded in green, which is 5 of the 8, that means they're running 20% ahead of last year in terms of net operating surplus. Yellow means they're approximating what they were. Yellow means they're operating at less than the surplus. We have two right now. We have Manikiki and Shawnee Hills that are lagging the prior year. Could be different reasons. We're keeping an eye on those. Seneca's tracking about where it was. So when I look at it as a holistic picture, I think, okay, we've got 8 golf courses. 5 are doing extremely well. 2 are lagging a bit and 1's tracking pretty close. And so I'm sure the team in operations and Damien are looking at, hey, what can we do to get those two to where they need to be? But as a group, golf is doing extremely well. And again, the star performer, we always mention this, is Washington is just doing great. It's, I'll give you the exact number. I'm sorry, it's Little Met this time. Little Met is running 101% better than it was last year. Usually it's Washington. Little Met kind of caught it. Those two run hand in hand. And again, we're digging into this on the budget side, why our 2 9-hole courses tend to do the best. It could be less operating expenses, more rounds can get played, but our two best performers are our 2 9-hole courses.
Again, keep in mind, those courses, you know, they were designed for, you know, losing a tremendous amount of money. They were upside down, the negative in a major way. And, you know, I think, you know, the breakdown of the other courses, I mean, they're still under that positive. You're still pushing 400, almost a half of them. I mean, those in Manakeega is a little bit less, but there's a bunch of work that we're doing there. So the construction expenses relative to the maintenance facility of that facility is by far the worst in the entire district. And so that's being worked on. We're working on windows. We're looking at a curb bar. We're looking at a pump station. So there's a bunch of things that are actually taking that number just a little bit different. So I don't want to diminish the jobs that both those superintendents and crews did based on this percentage.
Exactly. Thank you, Brian. Yeah, it's hard because when you're comparing a really good performer to a superstar, it almost makes the really good performer not be recognized. So we'll jump to enterprise. And enterprise, on the whole, if you look, I've highlighted the number right now. We're running on the revenue side $1.1 million ahead of the prior year. And that's primarily due to concessions. And a big part of that driver, when you look at the individuals, is Merwin's. Merwin's obviously now has been open longer, has been more staffed, and so it's helping drive that number. The one thing that stands out on a consolidated basis, last year through 10 months, it was operating at a slight surplus or deficit. This year, it's a net positive. And with the program that's coming up in November, December, the goal is that we maintain that. So through the end of the year, that the enterprise operation as a whole, holistically, runs at a net positive. And then we have some of the individual results. We've highlighted this often, it's a repeat comment, but East 55th, it's down due to the impact of when we installed how we do our dock rentals and we put that online, that they could do it online, it changed the timing of the payments. And so many of the 22 payments were made in 21. And we've talked about that throughout the year. So that's why their revenue at the top, if you see, lags a little bit, although it's catching up. It's catching up. And but it bears pointing out that that makes this number a little bit, well, this is going to be artificially high once we get to November, December, and this one's going to be artificially low. But on this page, I thought everything looked good. There was nothing that I put up things because I know you have a lot of material. If there's something that I think needs to be brought to your attention or is a concern, I put it up. But there was nothing else on these individual units that I felt was concerning. I did want to point out here, and it's green just because it's great, and that's parking. And it, what a great decision by the Metro Parks, by the board, and by the CEO to acquire parking. Do it the way you do it, because now you generate $400,000 that can be deployed to other things within the park district to enhance everyone's experience and improve what we do. And that's compared to $108,000 through 10 months last year to $400,000 this year. That is such a dramatic turnaround. I don't even know how you describe it, other than it was an unbelievable decision to do what you did to drive revenue and allow that parking revenue to drive enterprise and support other functions in the park district. And commissioners, with that, that's the highlight of everything. It was a good month. We're rolling into the budget season, which we'll be talking about briefly later. But all in all, we're in a good spot.
So a question, and I guess it's kind of a programming question. We've talked about it before with Munis. You're kind of captive to a 2-year window of comparison. So each year you move incrementally forward and you're comparing the preceding year, which is valid. But can we use like some kind of a benchmark, like you go back maybe 5 years or 4 years, something where you can say, since that fixed point in time, compare this year, not only with last year, but with that prior. So you have a sense of the trends and the, I mean, I know you all do it, but is it something that we can do visually, or is the programming just too complicated.
I think we have enough data now to do something similar, and I think actually maybe on the quarters of the year, there should be a look back, because, you know, when you're looking at month by month, you could have a wet rainy season, which could change the percentages.
You explained it very well, but I'm just thinking, is there a visual?
So I think maybe quarterly, that would be a look back to a three-year period to actually see the chart of the pushes and pulls. So, yes.
But is it the right, if you're saying three years to look at? Because
I was just thinking the same. Go ahead.
Eventually, we get 1 year past that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, 23 will actually be 21, 22, and 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, COVID.
It is what it is. I mean, golf did well during COVID. So the numbers, you know, the statistical analysis, candidly, it is what it is. I mean, you have to explain it because it sits on our books.
I just think we'd have more of a long-term trend, a little more.
Yeah, Commissioner, you're exactly right. And that's what we do. Do I look back at probably about 5 years, I discount or take out the COVID year, but Brian's right. We'll get information together on a quarterly basis that will help.
I think it would help everyone just.
And help everyone.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Wade. Moving on to new business, Brian.
Thank you so much. The first action item of a large agenda is the 2022 budget adjustment number 11. Wade.
Thank you, Brian. Commissioners, on page 9 of your material, you'll see budget adjustment number 11. The net effect is $176,491. The primary change is our hospitalization expense appropriation is being reduced and transferred over to capital projects. We did a great job. HR did a great job of controlling health insurance costs or hospitalization expense. And so we were able to repurpose that into capital projects. But the net result is that there is no additional dollars being appropriated. This is all for revenue donations, grants that have already been previously received but unappropriated. I would ask for your approval of action item 2022 budget adjustment number 11.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Second action item is the request for approval for the 2023 rates and user fees. Wade.
Thank you, Brian. At the top of page 10, item 2, there's detailed information in the originating source. I'm the presenter, but this was done in collaboration with Dr. Kuhar, with Joe Rozak, and Kelly Manderfield. As we looked at all of our rates and user fees across the parks, we've made some modest adjustments, and almost all exclusively due to inflation. Our cost of providing services throughout the park district and what we do has been impacted by the inflation of this past year that we've talked about. But the detailed user fees are included. They're in pages 65 through page 80. And those will be used in preparing the 2023 budget. I would ask your approval of the 2023 rates and user fees.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the additional interim depositories of public funds through September 2025. Wade.
Thank you, Brian. When the Park District changed banking relationships to Huntington National Bank, they did not identify any additional interim depositories, which only means that we can take our excess funds and invest those other places. I'm asking you to approve an additional interim depository of Key Bank so that all of our money does not sit at one institution and we can take advantage of rates. If that bank's rates are a little bit better than Huntington's, we can move money back and forth, being held almost to just one institution, which is where we are right now. As well as then, Huntington has our banking relationship. We also set up Huntington National Bank as an interim depository so we can move money into maybe a short-term investment that'll generate more interest earnings for us.
Recommend action is on the top page, portion of page 11.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the RFP 64446 for stable operation renewal. This is Rocky River Stables. This has been a long-standing relationship with Valley Riding. We look to continue in a very similar fashion from an annual remittance of moving to $7,950 total capital investment. Cleveland Metro Parks continue to make investments in not only the bathrooms, but the roofs. They are a strategic partner with us, providing value to the patrons, including therapeutic riding. It is the recommended action to renew their contract through 2025, the top portion of page 12.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the adoption of the revised policy, trademark and logo usage policy. This is something that we look at once every 5 years. It is pertinent to bring in front of the commissioners to make sure they see the fact that we own mark and names and logos, which are very important to the organization. The policy sets forth the authorized use for referring to Cleveland Metro Parks brands, trademarks, and products. This can be found between 81 and 86. If there are no questions, the recommended action falls on the bottom portion of page 12.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next is the authorization of a land acquisition, the Stowell property. This is in Big Creek. This is a 1.45 acre piece of land. This is on Fowles Road. As David brings up the map, you can see that it's a very strategic piece of property to continue to buffer the Lake to Lake Trail. When this was originally brought forth well over 12 to 14 years ago, we had looked at a very narrow strip that actually goes underneath the railroad. Since then, most of the properties that have been near there have come to the park, very specifically wanting to sell their properties as they were aging out. This is another very strategic piece of property just to continue the buffer along the way. Eventually, we have a plan to connect through to Mill Stream Run Reservation through the bottom portion of that. You can see some of the dotted line trails. Those are earthen trails. But eventually, we'd like to bring it all the way down into off of Main into the Mill Stream Run Reservation. So this is just another opportunity to buffer. This is a 1.45 acre piece of property. Recommended action falls on the middle portion of page 13.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the authorization to submit a grant application to the U.S. EPA's Brownfields Assessment Program. This is a very unique opportunity to provide an assessment really across basically Cleveland Metro Parks service area, with the exception of the city of Cleveland. They plan to pursue the same type of funds for their jurisdiction. However, we looked at the opportunity to look at other properties throughout not only Cuyahoga, not only our area, but Parmadale, City of Parma, Silver Oak Land Development. There's a host of others that this assessment could look at the end goal of creating public green space. Again, this is a request for the property assessment. There is no guarantee. Again, this is a submittal for a grant application to the U.S. EPA Brownfield Community-Wide Assessment Grant. Falls in the bottom mid portion of page 14.
So this is to look at property we don't own to determine?
Yes.
Cumulative acreage?
Can be anything.
Yeah, it's basically to give you a pot of money. You get to use it to assess properties anywhere within that service area.
Yeah, but we're looking at specific, we're targeting.
Those were just, I would say, generalizations of opportunities that we could use the funds at, but it also can be used in the future if we find another piece of property. Yeah. We just kind of designated of where we have the potential to look at these properties.
Got it. Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the authorization to submit grant application, commit funds to install and maintain navigational buoys. We have worked on this program for a number of years through the ODNR Watercraft Grant Program for the navigational buoys. This is, again, the designation of the no wake areas and five buoys to designate no boats at Villa Angela, Euclid Wildwood. It is required that we have a resolution for this. It falls on the top portion of page 15.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is on the Lakefront Reservation. This is authorization to enter into a grant agreement and commit funds. We received a grant of $272,500 from the National Fish and Wildlife Sustain Our Great Lakes Program to add green infrastructure elements to the parking areas at Edgewater Park and the Lakefront Administration Building. This has been very consistent with Cleveland Metro Parks has been doing, removing as much water as we possibly can. When we look at Edgewater Park area, the paved surfaces, we let about 10,800 feet of vegetated bile swales to the existing. Our goal is to reduce almost 3.6 million gallons of water per year to actually be contained on site. We're doing the same thing in the 1.5 acre parcel up at the Lakefront Nature Preserve. We continue to try to find very creative ways to take the water offline and control on site. We will get some funds through Great Lakes, H2 Ohio, and then Metro Parks putting some funds in as well. Recommended action falls on the top portion of page 16 to enter into the grant agreement.
And this is water quality control too, right?
Correct.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the operating agreement for 2023 between the Cleveland Metro Parks and the Cleveland Zoological Society. This has been a long-standing relationship. There are no proposed changes. We have Sarah Krupe and Eustacia here from the Zoological Society. On behalf of them, they continue to fund capital projects to and include the opportunity to fully fund the new bear exhibit. The operating agreement does have a split of membership revenue that helps continue to bring both agencies positive results moving forward. Again, there are no recommended changes for the 2023 operating agreement. Falls on the top portion of page 17.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is RFP 6674, construction manager at risk for the Huntington Playhouse. We have continued our long-standing partnership and work with Bay Arts. This is through, again, the Huntington Playhouse, their modification, which is now underneath their control. We did an RFP. We did a short list. We interviewed three firms. We are now proposing that we negotiate a contract with Regency Construction for the work that will be going on at the Huntington Playhouse. This is something that will kind of happen in phases, depending on how the money is able to flow through Bay Arts to Cleveland Metro Parks. We will run the project with their funds moving forward. Recommended action falls in the middle portion of page 19.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is contract amendment 1553 Heritage Park, Heritage One and Rivergate Boat Slips, construction manager at risk. This is the GMP3 that we're bringing forward. We're, I would say, rounding third and heading to home. There will be some things because of supply chain issues that we'll probably have to do a GMP4 correction.
Wraps it up, what we may.
What we may. So we'll see how it goes. Hopefully we can tie everything into this, but this is essentially filling out the work that Cleveland Metro Parks was able to get through the boating infrastructure grant, providing boat slips between Heritage Park 1 and Rivergate along the way. So again, they've done a fantastic job, and we look forward to being able to open them in the spring of next year. So the GMP3 is in the bottom portion of page 20.
How many slips?
18 slips. Plus two lockers.
Will we charge people to use these slips, or how will that work?
Commissioner, you ask a very good question. I think it's one of the things that we are still working on. There is no, we're looking at a couple of different options is all I can tell you at this point in time. We believe potentially at Rivergate, it will be more of a transient lunchtime coming in, coming out, and kind of a turn there. I don't know that we want to get in the overnight business. So part of that, we have to comply with what the grant tells us, but there is no, it's not as easy as like a parking lot, but we may use an app that actually allows for that. So we're kind of working on
that. So do we have a traffic light for these things? I mean, it's a navigable channel. How do we regulate?
Yeah, the positive is that they're actually, they basically can nose in out of the channel, and there's a few that are parallel out of the navigation. So out of the federal jurisdiction, they're actually off of that. So we work very creatively to figure out how to get the most amount of slips for public access, because there's really been no public docking on the Cuyahoga River for a long period of time. And if it was, they weren't necessarily in what they called the safe zones or the designated zones. By going through the Army Corps, the Boating Infrastructure Grant, we worked with all the agencies along the way to make sure that we were in compliance with all of those things. Joe, anything you want to add on the operational side?
No, I'm floating parking lots. They could go along what we're looking at. So people who are coming along, they see a spot that's open, they go and they take it. We look at overnight docking. We surveyed all of the yacht clubs and whatnot along, and they have capacity. They're never sold out. There's always available overnight transient docking available, which is why we kind of pivoted to the daily user. So they're coming by, they want to go to Merwin's, they want to go to Flatiron, they want to take a bike. If they come over, put their boat, they're both there, and then go and enjoy the environment outside of the water and come back to the boat and continue.
So two questions. There's no employee there staffing it.
Currently, that has not been the plan. We don't know that would be a cost effective.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking of the price. And then what happens if somebody does leave their boat overnight? So they enjoy a restaurant, decide they have to Uber home.
Right. You know, everything will reset overnight. So there's a chance our police will be able to enforce parking like they do our parking lot. So we're trying to use the same app so they have the same back end access and see who has paid and left to put in their boating number as we turn up their time. So there is the ability to force people who have overstayed their time commitment. But we, you know, if that does happen, hopefully it's for a good reason.
Right, right.
Final question. Do we incur liability because we're charging?
Yeah, it's actually part of the condition of the grant that we actually have some revenue. So, you know, we have parking lots, we have slips at other marinas. This is an uncommon thing.
But I mean, for this location, it's okay.
Joe, can we leave these docks through the winter?
They're built to leave over the winter, and our plan is to leave them this winter and see how it goes. But we also have the ability to remove them.
It's expensive to build dockage, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we're very thankful. I mean, you know, Kristen and our grants team hosted the folks that help administer the big grants, the boating infrastructure grants. And a lot of times they go east, west, and south, you know, east coast, west coast, and the southern parts of the states. Having said that, there has been nothing. I think the 50th anniversary of the Cuyahoga River definitely helped as an opportunity. They also looked at the fact that there was no dockage, public dockage along there. The fact that we could also deliver the project. I think is really good. The very unique thing about Rivergate is the well where the boats would have come in and out from the old Commodore Club. That is actually the ADA accessibility. So we were able to achieve that coming out of the water, which isn't always as easy as intuitive. So I'm very proud of the work that they were able to do to actually accommodate all of that.
It can be great.
Very good.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Want to make sure that I didn't skip ahead and get in trouble with Brittany. Ohio Department of Transportation's Municipal Bridge Inspection Program. This is for 2023. We have worked very closely with ODNR from time to time. They initiate a program to actually help local municipalities. They are bringing forward the same type of program. They will perform our inspections across the park district in the rates and capacities that they will have. Again, the ones that aren't performed by ODOT will be formed by Arcadis, which we've used before in this process. So the recommended action falls in the bottom portion of page 21, just to continue and execute the preliminary legislation with ODOT for our bridge inspection program for 2023.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is we have an emergency contract 6707 Gorge Parkway retaining wall, the extension. This is potentially going to be a theme. We did one section a few years back. It's 2018. We had a process by which we fixed about 100 linear feet of the retaining wall due to a slope failure. We have a very similar situation currently. We may at some point in time bid the cost per square foot so that we have this on contract, just for the fact that we own tremendous amounts of linear feet of parkway adjacent to riverways. This one has just been one of the challenges that we've most recently had. We want to get in there to repair it as immediate as possible. So this is down in the Bedford Reservation. We look to enter into a contract with Suburban Maintenance to continue the work that they did. They did a very good job on the last work. We want to be able to bring that forward. The recommended action is on the bottom portion of page 23.
Do we think this is going to keep creeping, or?
It has the definite potential to. So I think we may look at more of a substantive fix after we get through this. We'll do an assessment to figure out if there are key ways to actually hopefully prevent it, so we're not coming in on the post versus so we can go pre.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next, the tabulation of award and bids. This is basically setting up the season from mulch to information staffing, pit toilets, testing, backflows, purchases of disposable wares, capital equipment, various office supplies, ice cream, and beer and wine. Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 24.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Approval of vouchers and payroll.
Thank you, Brian. Commissioners, I would point your attention to page 42, resolution 22-11-158. Where you will see the list of vouchers for the month of October totaling $10,592,254.54. They've been reviewed as to their legality and they conform with the high revised code. I would ask your approval of resolution 22-11-158.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next
Harbor.
The next resolution is resolution 22-11-159. Again, it's for vouchers totaling $399.38. Again, they've been reviewed for legality and they conform to the Ohio Revised Code, and I would ask the board to approve resolution 22-11-159.
Abstain.
Mr. Morris abstains. I'll second that. All in favor? Aye. Public comments. Good morning, Marty. How are you?
Really snowed up in the upper east side. Actually, you couldn't get up Cedar Point Hill, and after I got down Lewis Hill, you couldn't get up Lewis Hill either. So there were about 50 cars that were trapped at the bottom of the hill.
Wow.
So that was...
Well, you should never be late again, but your excuse is done.
Anyway, good morning. Since you just won a generous increase from the voters, it's a good time to push for clarity in how it's spent. For example, the agenda doesn't state how IT funds were spent the last 2 years, but now you're going to award twice as much money to some or all of 21 different vendors or even additional ones. Given the $250,000 allocated for this IT work is based on an RFP from 2 years ago, it all seems rather vague. Nothing spelled out and thus hard to monitor. Who got what, why, and what for? As opposed to the very specific detail regarding the backflow work for which increased costs are laid out and explained. Another confusing appropriation is the nearly $2 million adjustment being moved from hospital expense to capital projects, and then from capital projects again moved partly to the plot settlement and expenses, and partly to other contractual services, thence on to audit software with a separate contractual service transfer for retail point of sale. Other contractual services also serves as a middle step en route to technology equipment and separately to minor computer equipment. If this sounds confusing, it certainly is. One wonders why adjustment monies could not go directly from one department to their final destination. Ability to do monthly budget adjustments seemingly should be more straightforward than the old quarterly moves, but those were simpler. Clarity in public funds is a high priority. Unsurprisingly, Merwin's Wharf barely broke even last month in spite of some mighty nice weather. So, of course, it's still in the hole for the year. Is this really the best use of taxpayer dollars? Now, Enterprise as a whole also shows a loss. Enterprise admin expense has risen by a third to nearly $1 million year to date, and yet results are worse than last year. It's not good. Finally, the most essential use of public money is for public safety. As the Hawthorne Bridge is being replaced and you are working with ODOT bridge inspectors, please use extra diligence. As you know, the Cedar Point Bridge has been closed for over a year, with another year now added to the original estimate. Turns out that first the piers required replacement, and now the interior beams are also needing replacement. It started as a deck replacement. None of this was anticipated, even though regular inspections were done. Significant damage was missed in both these cases. Take this as a warning and trust but verify that these inspections are adequate. Then please be certain that the added costs for Cedar Point are not pulled from the replacement design. Perhaps ARPA funds or chip in with some of your new money, but do find a way to assure another attractive gateway for Rocky River Reservation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just as a clarifier, Marty's facts are inaccurate. Cedar Point Bridge is not Cleveland Metro Parks.
I didn't say it was Metro Parks.
You just said taking our funds, so we'll clarify.
The Cedar Point Bridge under construction right now is Cuyahoga County's responsibility. They have been communicating with us along the way. Yes, it's taking longer, but the end result will likely be worth it. But also like to say that we've been recently awarded funds to completely replace Hawthorne Bridge, working with the state of Ohio and the municipal bridge program. It's the first time we've ever been eligible for that bridge, and they funded us at $2 million. So we're very excited to be able to fully replace Hawthorne.
Thank you. Any other public comment? All right, fantastic. Let's move on to our informational items.
First reading of the multiple policies. Each and every year we try to bring clarity through what we do from a government standpoint, and Kyle will highlight a few of the policy issues that we have coming forward.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, commissioners. So this policy was originally brought forward to the commissioners back in, I believe, 2017, and so it's up for its review process here. It previously was an internal policy, but the staff felt like it was important enough to bring to a board level policy. So this is the property line encroachment policy and the conservation easement stewardship policy. They kind of work hand in hand. And I'd particularly like to commend Nate Hoover in the real estate department has kind of led this charge, and he's worked closely with park operations and natural resources and other folks to refine the policy. We've had some success through the first 4 or 5 years of the policy, but also realized some issues which we could improve upon to improve processes. Obviously, we have lots of neighbors, so it creates a lot of challenges, but we've improved those processes. So there's some, I would say, refinements to the policy that you'll see, and they are a little bit nuanced, so that's why we're doing two readings of these, so the commissioners have a chance to review them, and also the public. And then the conservation easement stewardship policy, which goes hand in hand with the property line encroachment policy, is also updated, although a little less substantial.
I guess a dumb question. There's really no way we can be proactive other than to post this, because there are so many adjacent parcels. In other words, to just other than a title search, people typically don't know. So we're in a more reactive mode just by the nature of things.
Kind of pushes and pulls both. Pre-COVID, we actually had two interns that actually proactively went out and walked massive portions of the reservations. And tried very hard to interact with residents. And so we try for a proactive approach.
Yeah.
However, as we're continuing to add property, there are some things that we have to work on cleaning up as part of that. There's also, institutional knowledge of kind of how some of these things work. So I want to tell you that our natural resource managers continue to do diligent work. Our park managers do the same. So we're trying to, I think, continue to walk forward on this. It's a process, and I think it will be something that we'll be working on every year.
But what's neat about this, though, was the Good Neighbor Guide. I'd never read it before, but it seems that it really gives, once something flares up, way to be diplomatic to get it done. I think that's a good approach, kind of a soft touch, but still determined to get it done right.
Each one of the encroachments has its own unique set of circumstances. Yeah. And so we try very hard to find an end positive net result.
Yeah.
Are there ways, do we know that everything does show up when someone does a title search? I mean, I know not every single person does, but I feel
the answer is no.
Yeah. But are there ways to make sure that, like,
yes,
that it does rise to the top or something?
So a lot of this,
there is.
a lot of this is not really even title related. It's more like, that's more the conservation easements and the restrictions, which is very important, but different a little bit from property line encroachment issues. That's mainly just boundaries, right? And
like,
so,
really understanding where they are.
Yeah. And so with the advent and better, mapping technology, like more recent aerials, we can really do a lot.
It's a great spot for a garden. I don't like that swale. Yeah.
and the pandemic.
Volleyball court.
Yeah. People expanded their home use of outdoor space during the pandemic. So it created a lot
of
changes.
Look at my backyard.
So we've been proactive. And, some of these aerials come up every 3 months, so you can get a really good, kind of progressive.
Yeah, that's a little spooky. That's pretty cool.
Of how it started around this time. And
gotcha.
I appreciate all the team's work on that. So that's the, again, kind of the first reading relative to that. Second is just the Institute of Public Procurement, MIGP, Accreditation for Quality Public Procurement. This is one of the, I think, true tie-ins to Cleveland Metro Parks. How we purchase things, how we use taxpayer dollars in the most efficient way possible. We have now been awarded this 12 consecutive years in a row, the 13th time overall. I want to commend Charlie and the finance team that is able to put this, through. The Metro Parks was only one of two agencies, one of only two in the state of Ohio, and only one of the and one of 17 special districts between the U.S. and Canada. So again, I think when the public puts their dollars and trust in us, they know that we're purchasing properly. Also, they've received the 2022 National Procurement and Institute Achievement and Excellence Award. So I would continue to give them a round of applause for their diligent work spending taxpayer dollars. Speaking of finances, the next information briefing item we have is the 2023, wow, it's hard to believe, budget preview. Wade?
Thank you, Brian. And if I can, back to the award for procurement and acknowledgements to Charlie and the staff are due, but I also want to compliment our chiefs and others within the organization. I mean, purchasing only works if everybody works together. I know we have some chiefs here that they work with the purchasing team to make sure that they do everything correctly and as efficiently as they can. And so that leads to the award. So I think it's an award that purchasing gets recognized for, but it's an organization-wide award that everyone participates. Okay, this is a quick snapshot of this started back when the 2013 levy was passed and it's carried forward. We're gonna focus in on now, if we can, just to the 2023 section, which is, yeah, Dave is going to pull that over a little bit. It's kind of hard. What I wanted to point out, and I think this is important to note, and you'll see the revenue number, we started this process back in August, late July, early August. We didn't know that the levy was going to be approved or not. And so we went forward assuming that revenue right number right there. And we've maintained that. This is a very tight budget. You can see that I think we're going to end the year with about $27 million in available cash. And if not for the levy, we would end the year with about $16 million in cash available, a very tight margin on an organization with about $140 million budget. And what I wanted to point out, and it was mentioned earlier, that in my almost 40 years in public finance, when organizations get additional monies, they can do one of two things. They can quickly spend it or allocate it, or I think the more appropriate process is a thorough and strategic analysis and conversation about the best use of those dollars and how you use those over a long period of time. So what I'm going to do in the budget process is come back after we get our first half settlement and see what additional revenues the new levy, which was just passed, provides, and propose an adjustment in that estimated revenue number, along with a conversation between the CEO and the chiefs and the board on how do we best start to deploy that now. But to put it into the budget right now would not be a wise way to go forward. So this is the budget we'll be bringing forward about this budget. So you'll see that it'll be $129 million in revenue. And certain things like this line, you can't read it all, but that's grants, donations. $7.4 million, I want to raise this up. That's what we know pretty much for certain. I am pretty confident that Natalie's going to beat that number. There's going to be new monies added into there. It'll be close to this number. But I can't give you that in a budget, even if I have a good sense that it'll be higher. I can only give you what I know for sure. So that's what we know for sure. We've taken every position in the organization, budgeted that out if they're all filled. Operational costs have gone up. And I do want to point this out before the preview ends. $14.5 million is $2.3 million for equipment, $1.2 million for land, and $11 million for capital construction. Again, I know there's some chiefs here. That's very tight compared to what we've had in the past. But as we get additional grant dollars and others, this number goes up. Because the revenue number goes up, we can now spend money on different capital projects. But as they work to do their budget, and I want to compliment the chiefs, they worked really hard, sharpened their pencils to say, how do we stay within this number? But we've just had a levy passed, and we thank the taxpayers for that. And so we will do an analysis and talk with Brian, and he will talk with the board about how do we now use those additional dollars? What are we looking at doing? But this is a first snapshot. I wanted to let you know where we were, what we've done over the last couple months, and we will be coming to you in December on the 15th with a complete detailed budget for 2023.
I think just as a note in that 14 in letter G, as we've represented for many years, Hinkley Lake Dam, it will be one of the larger capital projects that the park will undertake in this next 10-year cycle. It's going to take the lake out of commission for probably two seasons.
depending on the dredge material and the build. We're also, you know, monitoring, we have one last granting source that we're trying to get some potential funds. The other thing is we also know concrete is very expensive right now, so we're trying to find creative ways to do that. The other thing that is sitting there is the zoo project, the Zoo 150, the sesquicentennial. So we sit at 140 years over this next 10 year. We have proposed the build out with our partners between the Cleveland Zoological Society and a host of other sponsors and hopefully donors to build out the gorilla exhibit. And so that will be a large undertaking. I think, again, respect for, you know, the taxpayers and transparency. We did not over budget. We did not think to a higher level. We stayed within our means for this year. If the additional revenues, those will help seed those capital projects, those larger capital projects, because we can only do those within the 10-year window that we have. And so we're going to need to raise the funds, capitalize, and then be able to develop a construction schedule that will actually be able to draw it down and build it in the proper amount of time. So those numbers, those we'll be making those adjustments as we're moving forward.
Okay.
Thank you, Wade. We will move into a natural resources update. John Rainier. Oh, Jen, are you going to speak to her or are you just getting coffee?
John's got it.
Very good. Does he have a power? Oh, is this your first time with the PowerPoint here?
It's been about 4 years.
Do you need a tutorial? You can be good.
You want Sean to help out or?
Okay.
Look at this. Not a rookie.
All right. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm really happy to be here today to talk to you about the progress we've made with our natural features and rare species inventory over the last 10 years. Personally, it feels like a great time to look back at some highlights. I just passed my 10-year anniversary with the park with another levee cycle passing. It just feels like a great time to look back at some of these highlights. So all the rare species work we do in the park is part of our natural features inventory program and natural resources. The natural features inventory is our effort to kind of document and characterize everything natural in a park. So species, habitats, geologic features, anything natural of interest occurring in the park. And it really grew out of the wetland inventory program that I started working on 10 years ago. I was out there mapping wetlands. While I was doing that, we were really racking up quite a list of new rare plant discoveries in the park. So we started kind of databasing all this stuff. And then started looking back at historical known locations of rare species in the park, going there, seeing if they're still there, and then also looking at new, never before surveyed areas. And it's proven that Cleveland Metro Parks is quite a hotspot for rare species. In 2009, we had an internal list that showed 12 state listed, right, endangered, threatened, potentially threatened species in the park. Five of those were thought to be gone from the park completely. We're now at 55 to 60 state listed species. Many of those that were thought to be gone from the park actually were not gone from the park, rediscovered new populations. So pretty exciting stuff. So this is just showing our effort of our natural features inventory. This represents about 90,000 observations just from our internal resource monitoring and assessment programs. Pretty good coverage over the whole park. And then if you look at,
is that all field work or is it
GIS? All field work. Yep, all field work.
John, this isn't part of that camera program that we worked with Michigan State on over those years.
It is not. However, we are starting to kind of bring in some records of things we capture on camera into this larger inventory.
So you have that coexisting some database and field work.
Yep.
Yeah, data collection.
Yeah. Definitely. And then this is just showing our locations of all the species in the park that have some kind of conservation, high conservation value associated with them. So this represents about 1,200 observations throughout the park and over 200 different species. So, you know, one of the coolest things is to be able to find a native species occurring in a state that has never been discovered before. Because there's been botanical exploration over the state for a long time, right? So when you can document a species that nobody else ever documented before, super exciting. This is one of the big highlights of my time here. This is a beautiful plant called lovely shadbush. I found it just growing off the edge of a shale bluff. This was 3 or 4 years ago. I first found it. I just this year found another very large population in a separate place on another shale bluff. This species before finding it new to Ohio was only known from New York and adjacent Canada. So really small range, very rare species, very specific habitat type, just kind of hiding in plain sight out there. Hawthorns, I'm a hawthorn guy. Really
prickly.
Those big very stars. Thorny, and you'll find that several of the species I'm going to highlight are quite thorny. Maybe that's why nobody paid any attention to them. But you know, rough hawthorn, super. So we actually have a very rich hawthorn flora in Cleveland Metro Parks. A lot of species that are quite rare across their range. This was a highlight of mine. I actually found this first on a Sunday with my son fishing at Byers Pond. Came back on Monday to fully document it. I'd had my eye out for the species for a long time. This is kind of a Great Lakes Northeastern endemic with very few records across this range. So when I sent this to the hawthorn expert up in Canada, he was super excited that we had it in the wild. Smooth blackberry. This thing was just seemingly hiding out in our really cool, moist, deep ravines where we have lots of hemlock. It is a northern species, much more common when you get to the northern Great Lakes. It was on a lot of botanist radar, thought that it could be in Ohio. I just had my eye out for it and found several populations in our park and elsewhere in Northeast Ohio. This is currently listed as endangered. So this was my pandemic highlight. You know, the summer of 2020, obviously that was a crazy year. This plant had been on a lot of people's radar for a very long time. It seemingly just kind of dropped off the map. There were several very old records from Ohio. One particular record of interest to me was one from Strongsville, had some very vague location information for it. So lots of people looking for this, and on a very hot, steamy July day, I stumbled on some in a nice swampy depression in a floodplain. And you can see just this, so all these colors here basically show this species is very rare or gone now from almost everywhere where it was known to occur historically. We have a very healthy population now, and I gotta give a lot of credit to Tim Krynak, our natural resource area manager in this part of the district. He has done an awesome job taking care of the site where the species grows ever since we discovered it. Oh, wrong way. Okay, and I could go on and on for a very long time about all the different species. This is just to highlight, so every one of these pictures on this slide is an endangered species that was discovered recently in the park system. Some of these have come from new acquisition properties, which is super exciting. It's a real pleasure to work with the real estate team, grants, everybody involved in property acquisitions, because so many of these new properties are producing some really cool species records. I'm a plant guy, so I tend to focus on plants, and plant records are definitely more numerous than our wildlife records, but there have surely been plenty of cool wildlife records across the park, from insects to mammals, of course, trumpeter swans, now confirmed to be breeding in the park. You know, that's a species that was thought to be on the brink of extinction not that long ago. And then, you know, of course, we have great habitat for several federally listed bat species. So we're out there getting a lot of great information, not just about plants and habitats, but animals too. And a lot of credit goes to our wildlife ecologist, John Cepak, and a lot of our natural area managers who are wildlife experts and document a lot of this stuff.
What's the guy on the upper left there?
Sure.
That is a star-nosed mole. That's a species of special concern in Ohio. I apologize for the picture. It's actually a dead star-nosed mole. But sometimes that's the only way we find these things, right? You know, roadkill, you know. So I don't think we actually have any like live records of star-nosed mole, but we know they're around. I apologize. And again, more credit to our area managers. When we document special things at a particular site, we're doing a great job now of doing what we can to protect those sites. So whether that is, you know, discouraging access to unsanctioned trails that go by sensitive areas, or like down here, clearing large areas of invasive species that are having a detrimental effect on sensitive species, or like at Whips Ledges, you know, the trails crew did a great job of constructing some barriers around particularly sensitive areas to kind of cut down on that, really that free-for-all hiking that's going on around Whips Ledges, especially with the climbing. So, and it's already shown, I was there doing some sampling this year, already shown within these areas that are barricaded some positive signs of vegetation in there. Okay. We have just dramatically increased our knowledge of rare plants and rare species overall in the park over the last 10 years. And a lot of that is increased survey effort. You know, we've really focused on this stuff. We have experts on staff that can go out and quickly know what they're looking at. And that's a really important part of it. And then secondly, the increased land acquisition and protection, as I mentioned earlier, some of these new properties that are coming online are really exciting. You know, sometimes natural resources is involved up front. We know what's there. Sometimes we go in after the fact and we're like, wow, you know, never even knew this was there. You know, we really are doing a great job of picking up some of these last little bits of natural areas around Cuyahoga County and adjacent areas that that turn out to be pretty special in a lot of cases. And again, working with our natural resource area managers to really protect these sites once they're identified has been great, and just lots of successes. I can personally say I've been proud to say, I sit on the Ohio Rare Plant Advisory Committee. It's a statewide committee of experts that determines the status of plants throughout the state, and I've been able to take several species off the rare plant list because of the number of records that have come from the work that's been done here. So it's been pretty rewarding. And that's all I have. I'll take any questions.
I just want to thank John and Jen and the entire team. Our natural resources managers, and truly, when you look at the conservation of 24,000 acres, I mean, they do an amazing job. And, you know, but for what the commissioners have done, the 33 that preceded you, they've protected these lands, and that's what we were designed to do. So thank you for all you do.
Excellent. Thank you. That was good.
The next information item we have is uniquely positioned as structurally speaking. Judy McKeegan is here to share some photos of some of our more iconic park structures, old and new across the way. This is, I truly love these moments in history as Judy comes forward. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. I've had an idea lately that I need to like just highlight a few of these buildings, partially because of all the wonderful new capital projects that we've done. And I said structures because we're going to talk about a couple things other than buildings, but I always include this because this is our first extant oldest shelter out the Harriet Keeler Woods. This is it in 1928 when it was first built, that very rugged log cabbing look. And I think I've told the story before how I found that Stinchcomb actually designed this and ordered it from a company up in Wisconsin, and they sent it out in pieces parts, kind of like an IKEA kit coming into the park. And of course, it's still there today, though it did have a WPA extension on it. The front part is newer, 1934, if you consider that new. It's still there today and you can go visit it. And I just love to kind of stand there and because it just is such a link to the past. But the earliest construction in the park, you know, other than that one, was really very basic. We're talking like just little cabin in the woods. This is the original North Chagrin Trailside Museum done in 31. And it's just very, very basic, almost, you know, Adirondack cabins up in the woods type of thing. And this is a little concession stand. Isn't this adorable? If you could see it close, they're drinking Coca-Cola, I think, in there. So there's a little sign for Coke, yeah.
What year was that?
This is probably around 1930.
So we had an Enterprise division in 1930?
Oh, yes. There we go. Yes, we did. We had concession stands, of course. So, yeah, absolutely. That has been a big part of the park all the way along. And there's even rules on how pure the hot dogs that you sold had to be and things like that. So they had to be pure meat, no fillers, just so you know. There was a change kind of in architecture, and part of it we took advantage of, and these are new pictures rather than old because they're in color and I just like them better. That, of course, is the shelter house in South Chagrin Reservation, and that's all it was called. It was the shelter house, even though there were like, you know, many others, but it became the. And this is Bonnie Park down below. And of course, these are WPA projects. So we've got the stonemasons in, we got the skilled workers in, the woodworkers in. And I love how this is starting to show what is called parkitecture. Which is actually a thing. And I happen to be a fan of it. But I also love that the South Chagrin one kind of gives homage to the area it's in, to the Gates Mills kind of type of architecture with the little cupolas on the top and things like that. So they definitely were paying attention to that. And then, of course, as I said, parkitecture. And this is one of our good examples of it is Brecksville Reservation, Brecksville Nature Center, still one of my favorite buildings in the park, again, with the stonework and the woodwork, very much influenced by the national park type architecture, which is why it's called parkitecture, of the 1930s, almost trying to look like this building just kind of erupted out of the nature around it. That was the whole idea of parkitecture. I think Yosemite and all the big lodges, but it definitely was coming into play as we got these WPA projects going. And that's, of course, inside. And what's cool about that is that if you walk inside there today, those benches are still there. And that fireplace is, in fact, they probably have one going today. I would if I were there. But my favorite building in the park, and I know I shouldn't have one, is Lookabout Lodge. And this just is the epitome of that parkitecture, that miniature. It looks just like it would belongs out at Yellowstone or somewhere like that. Again, trying to pull in all the natural elements. And sadly, a lot of the building is made out of the chestnut trees that were dying at that time period, and they were harvesting the wood and using it in a lot of these buildings. And again, this is a modern interior picture because this is what it looks like. I was just there for a OE training last week, and I think it's just the most beautiful building that you could ever see. And it is the definitely the epitome of that parkitecture. But then nothing lasts forever, right? Tastes change. And by the 1950s and 60s, this more modern, quote unquote, looking, and you can tell it's not, I'm not a fan, but nobody asked me, right? I'm sure they were very proud of this. This is Bradley Woods when it was pretty new. This is 1963 picture of Bradley Woods reservation shelter. Showing kind of that Jetson era thing. And then the chalet, which was built in 67, also embodies kind of this new look. Because to me, a chalet should look like Heidi lives there. But this was, again, very 1960s sleek. And, you know, Mr. Brady from the Brady Bunch would have been a great architect for all this stuff. And the, again, the climax of that, I think, was our 1971 interpretive center out at Rocky River, built again in this very modern area, still looking, though, like it blends in with its environment. You know, it wasn't done in shiny steel and things like that. And then we kind of went back a little bit. So by the 1980s, it seems like there was a little bit of push again. This is 1984. This is the Nature Center, or the Interpretive Center, as it was called at the time, is Sanctuary Marsh, North Chagrin, a reservation. Again, going back to a little more of the wood stone look for this, for the buildings. Oh, and notice, of course, they were so proud of the fact that there were Canada geese there. And we did everything we could to protect and encourage them to breed.
We did a good job.
Yeah, we did a great job. Yes, it's nice to have a success story. Skipping ahead, of course, because I don't have time to show you all the cool buildings in the park, but this is, of course, our Watershed Stewardship Center out at West Creek Reservation, our first LEED building done with not only to look like it blends in, like the buildings in the parkitecture era, but also trying to protect the environment that it's being built into as well, because of methods of construction and, you know, green roofs and the way that they protect the watershed in that area with the building itself. And on to some, I don't know what to call this type of architecture. Sean, what do we call this? This is unique. Thank you. That's it. It is. It's very unique. Of course, you know, we did a lot of the buildings that we've done in the past since the centennial. This is one of my favorites. Even though I would love to have seen an absolute replica of Stinchcomb's beach house at Edgewater, that wouldn't have been practical at all. This one, this does blend in with the environment. It pulls you in. I couldn't find a picture of it that Kyle had taken with no people on it. And I thought, Well, that's because that's what belongs there is people. So let's just show this picture. Of course, it's at the end of the day with the sun going down. But even the building itself has just been such a draw and such an addition to Edgewater. And even if you drive by on the Shoreway, like I sometimes do going home, just looking at it from the Shoreway with that kind of bridge that goes behind it that you can't see in this picture, it's just a stunning building. And then when we did the Trailside Program Center, which is an addition to the campus of Brecksville Nature Center, I love that we kind of did homage, and this looks just like it could have been the big sister of the Nature Center right from the beginning. It could have been built right at that same era, but it is LEED influenced, again, trying to not only blend in with the environment, but make sure that we're taking care of the environment as we build our buildings for people to use. I could have shown the bathroom there too, because it's a nice addition to the bathroom. The bathroom, there's several bathrooms that are beautiful, but I didn't go that route. Of course, buildings are not the only structures. These are the original Fort Hill steps, which opened to great fanfare in 1983. And you can almost see the minute they were built, though, that there was going to be some problems, because this just doesn't look like a lot of thought went in. And I'm sure a lot of thought did go. I shouldn't judge the people from that era, but they were very useful and people loved those steps. But of course, we replaced them in 2016. Has it been that long? I think it was 2016 that we opened up the new Fort Hill steps, which are a lot more solid. They have a beauty of their own, as well as the beauty that you see as you walk up them. And bridges, of course, the Wendy Park Bridge, which I'll show in a minute, that we opened last year, got me thinking about bridges. And this was the Scenic Park Bridge that replaced the Ford up in the northern part of the valley of Rocky River Reservation, coming down past Scenic Park. And of course, this was the first time that we actually put a bridge over the all of the up until then everything had been Fords. Well, the flood of 1959 really destroyed that Ford, and so the decision was made to put bridges. This is the growth era, and he was kind of big on bridges. And so again, there's that 1960s kind of style of architecture, very sleek and very modern looking, and they were very proud of that. They had a big ribbon cutting and lots of people showed up for that. But of course, it cannot hold a candle to our lovely Wendy Park Bridge, which opened up in 2021. And not only was the day this opened up just such a beautiful day, and the bridge itself was beautiful, but it was the first time that we were all out together after the pandemic in a big group. And so it's the first time I saw a lot of my coworkers in person. So I have a real special place in my heart for the day this opened. Again, beautiful bridge, and of course, making connections, which is what structures should do. And finally, a reminder that not all of our structures are big, huge buildings or big, huge bridges. This is the overlook at Bonnie Park that we opened up earlier this year. And it's just a reminder that we have these lovely small, at least to me, though I know a lot of work goes into it from planning, design, and execution of the construction work and so forth. But it's just a reminder that we put these little types of overlooks, and we've been doing that since the very beginning too, just so that people have a lovely spot to look. And this is what you see as you're standing on that overlook, a reminder that we, that the real beauty of this park is the nature that's out there. So, thank you very much.
Judy, the last picture you showed of the classic architecture, the one with the fireplace, what was that called, and where is it?
That's Lookabout Lodge in South Chagrin Reservation.
Okay.
Yeah, yes. It was built as a partnership by the Natural Science Club, which at that time, we owned the land, we owned the building, but they helped to build it for use for their by their club.
Okay. So, great, thank you.
Excellent job, Judy. Thank you so much. I loved opening up the overlook. It's one of the iconic locations in Strongsville. Debbie was there. The mayor was there. You know, you think of Old Albion Road going up the side of that. I can't even imagine what that looked like to get across. But to see the work that Jen Greiser and the natural resource team and the granting team to get the money to basically knock out that dam to be able to have flow, and now to see how the ecosystem has changed, but still celebrating kind of the water and the riffles. It's a truly remarkable project. The next is a summary of the 2022 Zoo Conservation Funds. Chris, I think you took up the vast majority of this agenda, so.
And with that introduction.
That means that's a good thing.
I hope it's a good thing. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
So it is that time of year again where I do a quick summary of all the conservation work that the zoo has done in the past calendar year. And, you know, one of the reasons why we do this information item is to sort of define all the different buckets that the zoo funds conservation out of. We've made a decision as a park district that we don't want taxpayer dollars going outside the taxing district. So all of the international species conservation that the zoo does is cobbled together from a variety of sources. So part of this is just an information item on all the different sources that we use to be able to do this. And then I want to give you some updates, because it's one thing to be able to fund conservation work, but we want to actually have measurables that show that we're actually having an impact. So our 2022 distribution, like every year, comes from funds that come out of Cleveland Metro Parks, as well as funds that come from Cleveland Zoological Society. So a number of these funds are contract driven, such as the Aramark Conservation Fund, the Event Networks Conservation Fund. Those are driven by our external partners that we have contracts with. The Future for Wildlife Make a Difference Fund is part of our Quarters for Conservation program. So we have 50 cents from each ticket that goes into that fund. The Andean Bear Safe Fund is supporting funds that come actually from other zoos. And we are a lead organization in the Andean Bear Safe program, which is an AZA program. So we actually gather those funds and distribute those funds. So $257,000 are coming out of the funds on our side of the house. And then Cleveland Zoological Society is bringing forward $490,000. And that comes through both philanthropy from investment accounts from Cleveland Zoological Society, as well as the 10% of membership funding. And Brian mentioned that earlier with the, you know, the reauthorization of the operating agreement. That 10% of membership fund was a change we made last year. And one of the advantages of it is because of, instead of having a flat fee coming out of membership, we used to have $5 for each membership. What the 10% does is it allows us to grow that fund as prices increase over time, right? The AZA goal is 3% of your operating budget going towards species conservation. So that's great, but as the cost of operation goes up, if you're just doing it off of a flat fee, the funding source doesn't grow as well. So the 10% allows that to grow over time. So we're looking at a disbursement this year of $747,814. That does exceed the 3% goal for us this year. But as the zoo's budget increases with inflation and things that Wade talked about, we're going to have to keep an eye on that and keep working to make sure we're hitting that mark. And that's what I just said with CZS's funding allocation. So just some highlights on the programs, and obviously Brian mentioned there's an extensive write-up for each of these programs in the packet, but I just wanted to give a couple of these highlights because I think that they're really impressive. Roja Carnivore Project is our lion and leopard conservation partner in Tanzania. We've partnered with them for years. Roja actually merged with another conservation organization in Africa called Lion Landscapes. So that's a significant improvement because it increases the reach of the program. But one of the things that's most impressive is, you know, there's a camera trapping program where they've used, you know, basically citizen science to involve the community in the conservation initiatives. Only about 3,000 images were generated out of that program, which isn't a lot in the context of the Michigan State program that Brian mentioned. But what it does is bring the community closer together. And actually, through that camera trapping program, they were able to enroll 1,200 families in a healthcare program. And those 1,200 families are across 12 different villages in and around the area. They also were able to get 5 new Lion Engagement Officers, or LEOs, because you never miss the opportunity for a good acronym. Again, making sure that the people are connected with the conservation program. And this is a community where it was a rite of passage to kill a lion to become a man, right? So this is this completely changing a culture from killing lions to protecting lions. And this is a significant partner for us, and really proud to be associated with Ruaha and their lion conservation. The gorilla program, Dr. Kristen Lucas has been out for a couple weeks, and she'll be out for a couple weeks more. When she gets back, this is an information in and of itself as our gorilla conservation program. Obviously, the Fossey Fund opened their new campus. Dr. Lucas is now the chair of the board of the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund. Kristen's been involved in the Women in Science program with DFGF. So there's a tremendous amount of work that's been going on there. The one thing that I'll highlight here is the Growers program. There are only about 200 to 300 Growers gorilla left, and they are in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which isn't necessarily an easy place to work. And DFGF has been able to increase the amount of habitat for Growers that they support by 50%, and I had to write the number down, about 2,400 square kilometers of area that's protected based off of a lot of the work that's being done, and the funding that we provide really helps support that program there. So we're really proud of all the work that's going on with gorilla conservation. From the draft conservation perspective, well, a lot of what we've been doing is helping support a program for the draft conservation program called Project Twiga, which is actually relocating giraffe. So instead of having one isolated population where anything like a natural disaster, a major hunting event, or a disease process could really wipe out the population of Nubian giraffe, what Project Twiga has done is moved those giraffe to multiple locations. So they've gone from two populations of giraffe in Uganda to five populations, almost a 50% increase, over a 50% increase in the number of giraffe that are in Uganda. So that relocation, moving them to different locations, and a number of giraffe calf have been born from the animals that were relocated, where they didn't see as much population growth in the areas that they were located previously. So again, just the opportunity to move these animals, get them into the right habitat, make that connection between the animals and the habitat and the people is really important, and Giraffe Conservation Foundation has been a good long-term partner for us. The Asian Turtle Program, the one thing I'll mention with this, Dr. Mike Selig has been going over to Vietnam. He's been over there multiple times, and what Mike does is he really works at the sanctuary level, where he helps the staff there understand veterinary techniques. They take in a lot of injured, confiscated turtles, and Mike's been able to build capacity with the vets and the staff that are working with those turtles. We haven't been able to get over to Vietnam since COVID, but we hope that Mike will be able to return there next year and continue to grow that program. The one thing that I find amazing about this program is that the Asian Turtle Project out of Vietnam has documented two of the only three remaining Swinho's softshell turtles. So there are literally only three of the species left, and this program has found two of them. So much like what John was talking about earlier, there are probably more out there, but we need to know where they are in order to be able to protect them and make sure that they're not accidentally killed and put them in the right breeding situation. So really important program there. And then the second to last of our core programs, illegal wildlife trade. This is basically a catch-all for a lot of the programs that we work with around trying to help prevent trade. Education for Nature Vietnam, they actually have a number of projects where they have over 4,000 volunteers that monitor illegal wildlife trade incidents. They've moved a lot of these programs online, where you can actually go online and buy endangered wildlife. But what the program for ENV does is really seek out those programs, identify those programs, and shut down websites, shut down organizations that are basically trafficking in wildlife just through the internet. And this isn't dark web kind of stuff. This is just like you can type it into your Google browser. So finding those, figuring out who's running the operation, there's basically a lot of police work that goes into a lot of these illegal wildlife trade operations, because you have to figure out where it's coming from. What's the source? It's really easy to be anonymous, at least at first pass online. and a lot of these programs are working on it. The last program on that list there, the AZA Wildlife Trafficking Alliance, is a program that we've been supported through AZA for several years now. They're actually looking at bringing some wildlife trade information to the airport here in Cleveland. And my staff is prepared to work with AZA and bring that program to fruition. They wanted to start it in 2020. Like a lot of things that got delayed. The last of our core programs is the Andean Bear Conservation Alliance. And I think that this is a really impressive program. The ABCA, as we refer to, is a conservation organization that's an independent conservation organization, but it's really driven by Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. Kim Gopp has really been, you know, at the forefront of this. She helped create Andean Bear Conservation Alliance. We support Isak Goldstein and Robert Marquez, who are the two leaders of the program. So we're able to support them. We work really closely with our legal department to help figure out what are the best ways to be able to fund conservation when you're sending dollars to Colombia, when you're sending dollars to Peru, right? They really have to be careful about how you do that from a wire transfer perspective, making sure that everything's legit. But this program, again, is a program that's gone from a lot of sort of one-on-one grassroots effort to doing trainings. And that's what we do a lot of, is training and capacity building, doing trainings online, where we've actually increased the number of training participants by tenfold by moving the trainings online, helping support that, helping design the trainings, and involving not only the conservation professionals, but government officials in this. So Andean Bear Conservation Alliance is one of our really, really strong, successful programs. And it's a program that we're going to highlight when we open up our tropical bear exhibit next year. And then this is our catch-all program. This is our collaborations. And a lot of these programs are tied to new exhibits that we've been building or long-term programs. These aren't programs that we are heavily involved in, but they're programs that we've supported for a long period of time. They're a species of interest for us, or they are have some capacity relationship to how we work and interest of our staff. So we're really proud of this. This is where we get a lot of the rhino and tiger conservation projects fall under here, Snow Leopard Trust. You can see a lot of these fall into exhibits that we've built over the past couple of years or will plan to build. So these is kind of our, instead of being very laser focused, this is our attempt to be a little bit broader and cover a few more species. When you have, you know, 400 different species in a zoo, we want to try to make sure we're covering as many of them as possible. So with that, I just wanted to say thanks to Cleveland Zoological Society. They provide 2/3 of the conservation dollars that we're able to put into it this year, or every year, really. And then the last thing I'll mention is that this information item tends to focus solely on the conservation programs that are really conservation dollars associated. We do have other aspects of our conservation program. John mentioned the trumpeter swans. It's highly likely that those trumpeter swans that are nesting here in Cleveland Metro Parks are descendants from trumpeter swans that were bred and released by the zoo 20, 30 years ago. We had a big hand in the trumpeter reintroduction program in Southern Ohio. So those animals that are now starting to show up in habitat around the state of Ohio are probably the result of that. We've been doing reintroduction of garter snakes in Southwest Ohio for about a decade now. So we do all the breeding and all that work on there. And we've been putting hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of tadpoles back onto the island of Puerto Rico for Puerto Rican crested toads. So those don't show up here because that's just part of our normal operation where we're breeding and we're using an outside partner to help support those introduction programs. But those are a part of what we do as well. So with that, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Can I ask one question? Absolutely. What is the percentage of monies that we put into conservation, the percentage of the zoo's total budget?
So I can't tell you that answer to that question until we finish our operating expenses for the year of 2022, right? So I when I tell you that it's 3%, it's 3% based off of the original budgeted amount. We will spend less than that because of position management and a variety of other factors, things that just didn't get done in a given year or didn't get spent out. My guess is we'll be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 3.5%, depending on what the total expense budget for the zoo is.
And that would include the Zoological Society.
No,
that is Metro Park.
From an expense perspective, is only the zoo's expenses. It is only the zoo's operating budget that we base that off of,
okay,
because we are the AZA member.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you included their operating budget, then that number should be different. If you included the support services that the zoo receives from the larger metro parks, HR and finance and legal and all that, that number should be higher. But all from an AZA perspective, we're based on the zoo's operating budget, and that's what we do the math on.
I see.
Excellent work. Give them a round of applause.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's interesting when we have these information briefing items, you look at the mission, protecting nature, connecting communities, inspiring conservation of the world, all of the different, you know, presentations tie back to our mission. So I'm really proud of that. Following up with that, the next item we have is Dr. Laura Shook, and Chris, I'm sorry, Sean is going to introduce Dr. Laura. She has not been introduced to the board through an new employee, so we'll do it now.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Good morning, commissioners. Thrilled to introduce Dr. Laura Shue. She came to us in April from the Great Lakes Community Action Partnership, where she managed the GIS, Geographic Information Services, for many of the clients that they served. And I'm not quite sure what you guys were doing on Tuesday, but on Tuesday it was GIS Day for the entire country, and Laura was celebrating that with our Metro Parks team.
Wasn't everybody?
Everybody was celebrating. So yes, I introduced Laura.
I might need the tutorial. It's down, right? Okay, well, thank you for this opportunity. I am very happy to be here. And as Sean said, we did celebrate GIS Day on Tuesday, and both here and then I'm representing the GIS team, but then also all of the other GIS users. As you will see, we have quite a few among the Metro Park staff. Okay, so talking about the GIS team and what we see as our program priorities, we really want to provide relevant GIS and drone services to support and enhance the work that's being done across the park district and achieving the mission of the park district. We want to facilitate access to information, specifically spatial data. So when I'm talking about that, that's kind of what makes GIS unique. You have a database and you have the ability to visualize any of the data that you have in that database. And that database is special because it's spatially enabled, meaning that everything in there has a location associated with it. So that's kind of what makes the power of GIS. We want to augment communication through engaging visualizations. I mean, we all know a picture is worth 1,000 words, a map is probably worth about 10,000. And then you get into things like web applications and drone imagery, and all of the variations of what we produce is really incredibly engaging. Sometimes you see it on cleveland.com. Sometimes you might see it on our website. We want to leverage the resources we have through an open source platform. So one of the things that's really unique about the Metro Parks is that we do not pay for proprietary software for our GIS services. Now, there's one company out there that most organizations pay for, and it is very expensive. The decision was made years ago, long before I started here, to use an open source platform. And what that does is it allows for us to really do more with a lot less, and allows us to be a little bit more creative with what we're doing. We want to support internal and external conservation and research, and we also want to partner with external agencies to promote best practices within our region and within other park districts. And lastly, we'd like to promote STEAM education. Okay, so on this slide, there's two basically components. On the right side, you see a graphic, and that is showing all of the GIS users in kind of the different domains. On the left side is the specific services that the GIS team is providing. So let's look at the right. At the very top, we've got the GIS administration. So that's the GIS team, and then several other departments actually engage in that as well. We have people creating GIS data throughout the park districts. And surrounding that, we have the desktop GIS users. So those are kind of like our power users. But everyone in the park district has access to GIS. So that's kind of encompassing the internal users. We have a web application, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. It's called MapStore, and that's being rolled out this month. And then broadly, we support the external users. So this is the public. We have several public-facing web maps that they can access our data. On the left side, the GIS team, we create those applications for spatial data access. We do visualizations and rendering. We support the organize the drone program. We also engage in GIS development and database administration. We kind of head that effort.
And the ways we support the GIS users is we maintain the park-wide data layers. So it's really important that we have one official source for our boundaries, for our trails, and those types of things. So we maintain that. We support the desktop users in providing them with base maps and access to databases. We promote our best practices. And then the rest of the staff, we make spatial and tabular data available. We provide applications that support any job function, and we answer spatially based and data-driven questions. And then for our external users, we share data with stakeholders when appropriate, we facilitate collaboration, and we support publicly available applications. Oops. So this is the staff of the GIS team and the GIS administration. So Brandon Garman is our cartographer, and he created the graphic that's on the right. India Johnson is our geospatial developer, and she is our main drone pilot. She's been flying for over 3 years. I recently got my license, so I'm kind of a newbie in that regard. Tom Kraft is our GIS administrator, and a lot of what I am talking about today is really has been on the shoulders of Tom Kraft. He has done an amazing job, continues to do an amazing job, and we are very blessed to have him. And then I also include IT services as part of the GIS administration because we rely on their support extensively. So thank you to Anthony and all of his staff. Natural Resources, John Rainier, is a main GIS admin person. They have their own database, and the same thing with real estate. They have their own database, so Nate and Stephanie do a fantastic job. Okay, so on this slide, we've got this graphic on the left. I'm not gonna go through all the different components of it, but one of the things I want you to kind of notice is that we've got several GIS databases, and that's one of the areas that I would like to improve. We have data coming from multiple sources, and it would be nice to consolidate that. On the left side specifically, we have a couple departments that have a need to have access to GIS databases. They have data that they could input, but we don't currently have a means for them to do that. So that is a great way that we can improve. On the right side, we've got kind of benefits and challenges. I won't go through all of those, but I am going to highlight the fourth down on the benefits side, greater spatial understanding. So this is what I have learned in the 7 months that I've been here with the use of the open source platform is Tom Kraft. I'm going to pick on him again. He has an understanding of spatial data that you wouldn't get if you were using proprietary software. So that is one of those added benefits of using open source data is that you really understand the nuts and bolts of what goes into the databases. So on this slide, we are looking at on the left, these are the applications that not only we use in the GIS team and at the Metro Parks, but also that the GIS team supports the use of internally. And then on the right side, we're looking at the public facing products that we create and we support. So at the top on the left, that's QGIS, that's our desktop software. Fulcrum is our mobile data collection app, and that is widely used across the park district. I think there's great potential for kind of expanding the use of mobile data collection, and we're investigating another open source option for that. WebODM is our drone mapping software that's also open source. And then right under that is MapStore. So that is the GIS application that is going to be available for all staff to use. It's actually currently available if you want to go to the portal. But we're going to start a training effort on that. And underneath that, we have the print server, which is our old web mapping application that's become outdated and very difficult to support. The right side, you've got our applications that are available to the public. We have a web map, we have the mobile app, of course. We have print and digital media, such as the Pathfinder, and we also support those trail maps.
So we encourage yes. public collection of data that we can use, like sort of like people out there unsolicited, they can provide data back to us?
Yes, I mean, they're welcome to do that, and then we're gonna have to vet the data to make sure.
Unregulated, I mean, is that a...
So they don't have the means to actually add data to any of those. They would have to contact us and make sure that we get it in there.
Okay, so it's...
Okay. Yeah. All right, so internal service request. So I call this our GIS footprint. It's like, who do we touch within the Metro Parks staff? Planning and design, that's where we are housed. So we work a lot with the staff there in various ways. And other departments, basically, you're going to see every department on there except for finance and human resources. And Wade, I apologize, but it is a personal mission of mine to make sure. Actually, I've talked to Gary about some things that he would like to see in the GIS. So we support basically all of the rest of the Metro Parks. Okay, drones. So this is the fun part. Lots of people like to talk about drones, and there is so much potential for drones. The greatest challenge we have there is kind of managing expectations and really kind of deciding what we're going to do with our drones. So we use them in lots of different ways. I'm going to go through a couple slides to just show you. This is actually Garfield Pond Restoration in Garfield Park. So this is kind of showing within kind of midway between the beginning and the end of the project. What we're going to try to do is actually get out there and fly before project starts, maybe several times at key time intervals between the beginning and the end, and then at the end, so we can kind of do those comparisons and see what we're doing and how we're doing it. So this is a bridge that was recently inspected using a drone. So this is a new application of drones, and it actually contributed to the funding that Sean mentioned earlier. So we're going to use drones to help kind of document the condition of the bridges, condition of other infrastructure. A lot of what we use drones for is for marketing, and they had a campaign to create drone imagery and other images for all of the golf courses. So this is actually from Seneca. And then also our special events like Wild Winter Lights. This was last year, but I'm actually kind of looking forward to perhaps flying the drone myself this year. And what you're seeing here, this is MapStore. So this is that new web application for staff to use. It's internal and it provides a lot of functionality. I'm going to just kind of quickly go through. For example, this is one of our base maps and we have a little UR here. So I added that through an annotation. That's not actually a data set. So we have the ability to add annotations and share these maps with others, and you can change different things within the MapStore interface. Another aspect of MapStore is something called a GeoStory. So what this is, it's an interactive map that can let you highlight different locations. This particular GeoStory was created for a coordinated infrastructure group that planning and design is part of. And this is with the capital projects. So this is something that we could actually put out to the public and they could just view this and see what we're doing and where we're doing it. And then we have our dashboards. This is an example from our trail statistics. And what's really cool about the dashboards is you have multiple ways of presenting the same data. So different people might need it for different reasons. So this is kind of a summary dashboard. We've got the table version if you prefer to see your data in that way. And then you've also got charts, which makes it kind of easier to visually compare between the reservations and the different types of trails. And finally, we have our initiatives. So as Sean mentioned, we had GIS Day, which 11 staff actually talked about the ways that they're using GIS. And it was a 3-hour event. And we had 63 people kind of throughout the Metro Parks attend in some form or fashion for any length of time. We would like to continue to do GIS Day, but perhaps open it up externally next year so others can see what we're doing. We have the MapStore rollout beginning this month. We're working on training to make sure that everyone has all of the resources to use it. We're going to do virtual trainings, a self-paced training through our learning management system. We also have an initiative to understand all of the infrastructure that we have for GIS and finding a way, as I mentioned in that previous graphic, there are multiple databases. Well, we're going to let people continue to use their databases, but one of the things on the right you can see, we want to have this, what I call an enterprise GIS database, which means that within that, there's a lot going on in that cylinder, but we're going to consolidate the data and have it talk to each other, the databases, so that we have one way to access it, so it's all streamlined instead of kind of having things all over. And then on the right side, you've got the applications kind of going out to the public. And because we have a couple initiatives coming up that are pretty big, one of them being utility mapping. So that's kind of in my background, it's in my wheelhouse to do that. So that would be a great thing. It's going to take a while because we have a lot of reservations and a lot of ground to cover. But that's kind of one of our 5-year goals and get that established enterprise GIS. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Excellent job.
Yeah.
I don't get an often chance to thank them, but when you look at the success of the agency, it's most often tied back to GIS. Why? Because it's the mapping, it's the function, it's the functionality, it's the opportunity to have all of the things kind of put together. And Dr. Laura's put a really nice focus on lining up parts of the Rubik's Cube to actually make it more user-friendly. So I just want to say thank you publicly to that entire team that has done an amazing job for the Park District. So give them a round of applause. That is the end of the information briefing items. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, December 15th in this boardroom, the last meeting of the year. There is an executive session with three items.
Yes, is there a motion to go into executive session to discuss the purchase and acquisition of real property, collective bargaining, and then a personnel matter, the employment of a public employee?
Yes, there is. So moved.
Right, second.
Debbie Berry?
Yes.
Bruce Brinker?
Yes.
Dan Moore?
Yes.
We'll take just a brief minute and reconvene in a couple.
Thank you.